You are listening to a podcast from The National.
This is Extra Time, take two. A mere few hours after recording our original podcasts, the main topic of our conversation, the future of Ronald Koeman, has been decided. The Everton manager has now lost his job, so we are now back in the studio to re-record the top part of our show. I'm your host, John Turner. Joining me today, Steve Luckings.
Hello, mate.
And John McCauley.
Still here, mate.
Good stuff. I know you've got dinner plans later, so we'll try and be as quick as possible.
Was halfway out the door.
We'd also like to let you know we've recorded the other half of this show earlier on today, so fingers crossed no one else gets fired before we air. Right, gentlemen, Ronald Koeman has gone from the Everton job. He was expected to take charge at least of the midweek game. That obviously hasn't happened. He's now made way. We're not surprised, are we, that this happened?
No, in obvious recordings that our listeners will never hear, we were all saying, wasn't we, that in order for Everton's fortunes to change, they needed to make a change of manager. Results had been largely very poor. Performances hadn't been much better. The final score was the 5-2 hammering received by Arsenal at the weekend. And it's really no surprise. There was nothing about Koeman's his demeanour, the words that he spoke. There was a little bit of arrogance about him, I think, which kind of rubbed Everton fans up the wrong way. They turned on him largely in the last couple of weeks, and as history shows, once the board are largely supportive of Everton managers, but as soon as you lose the fans, that's the final death knell, and. You know, you've only got to look at Everton's performances, I think, to see that the changes that he made to personnel and formation during games had very little effect. And I think he gave them no choice that he had to go.
Cooks, the big issue was, I mean, tracks all the way back, even beyond, before the summer, with their knowing the future of Romelu Lukaku, not acting on it, not finding a necessary replacement. You know, that's where it all kind of started to go wrong in hindsight, and then it's kind of unravelled from there, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it was a kind of glaring weakness that he didn't address that issue in the summer at least. And as you said, I think it was February that they knew that Lukaku was on his way, maybe to Chelsea was his expected destination. So he had plenty of time. They knew that the investment was coming in before the summer transfer window, and it was significant investment at that. It was 144 million, nearly 150 million pounds.
Unprecedented in Everton's history. You wouldn't say they recruited badly. They just didn't replace Lukaku.
Yeah, exactly. And there was no... The people that they did create that we've touched upon before is the three number 10s that everyone says that they have with Rooney and Klaassen and Sigurdsson. They were all very similar type players, and there was no real kind of invention there, any pace. So they struggle right from the off. And then at the weekend, Koeman had taken off Ashley Williams at half time, and that's not the first time he's done that this season. He then brought on Tom Davies, didn't he?
Yeah,
kind of rejigged everything. And he's done that a few times, and it just smacked of a manager who didn't know what his right formation was, if he didn't have the right players in the right places to take the team forward. And if you look, as we said, if he spent nearly 150 million, they had real aspirations of breaking into that top six, you would say. And what are they? They're in the relegation zone. They're third from bottom, aren't they?
Well, yeah, this is it. They started it in 17th, did they? But because they got whacked so heavily, Stoke actually moved up a place. So, and you've also got a question, I think, that... You know, he does have different options on the bench. Now, you know, someone like Kevin Morales, someone who offers you something different, someone who can actually get in behind defences, and he's been largely ignored. I think you can look through their results this season. I think the defeat at home to Tottenham was, a real yardstick to measure where they're at. Like you said, they had aspirations of cracking the top six, maybe even going higher, especially after their summer outlay. But they're nowhere near that. They're absolutely nowhere near that. And it can all be traced back. You know, we said that most managers over the summer addressed where their main problems were. Manchester City recruited very heavily in the fullback area, and they're untouchable. Manchester United brought in a goal scorer, a flat track bully to blow away teams below them. They did that in Lukaku. Liverpool didn't address their problems, and Everton just left a massive gaping hole, a massive gaping Romelu Lukaku shaped hole at the top of their attack. Now, you know, there are not many strikers who can replace a 25 goal a season striker, but you know, Sandro and Wayne Rooney weren't the answers to that. You weren't even going to get a combined 25 goals from them two players, and that's been Koeman's massive failing.
So who do you think can kind of come in now? There's a few names that might be bandied about, and David Moyes was even being mentioned recently.
He was over the weekend, wasn't he? I thought that was a little bit of, you know, skullduggery, but and what it has done, John, I think Koeman's reign, and maybe Roberto Martinez's to a certain extent, it's shone Moyes' 11 years there in a much different light, in a much more positive light. And, you know, I think he's largely damaged goods now, and I don't think the owners would necessarily plump for him. But I don't know. You know.
If you were the owner, Steve, who are you bringing in for interview? If you're bringing in two or three names for interview.
I'm getting Carlo Ancelotti's phone number, and I'm getting him on a private plane, private jet, private helicopter, submarine, whatever he wants, to come to Goodison Park, asking him what he wants, money-wise, doubling that, and then giving him whatever contract he wants. But, you know, whether he's on their radar, again, you know, he's another manager who's lost his job this season at Bayern Munich. But, yeah, there's plenty of talent out there that they can go and get. It's whether they've got the players to fulfil that role. But yeah, I mean, you know, like even maybe someone like Duncan Ferguson, who served under Koeman. I wonder if, you know, there'll be a kind of nostalgia effect, although the nostalgia signing Wayne Rooney has largely not proved successful. So maybe steer clear of that one. But for me, Ancelotti would be top of that pile.
I think someone you mentioned earlier there, Sean Dyche. You don't like to speak of a manager that's already in a job, but he started the season fantastically with Burnley. He is someone that is constantly kind of touted for any sort of jobs that come up, certainly with clubs that are outside the top 6-7, the likes of Crystal Palace. He was linked with Leicester as well. So I don't know if that's a manager, or that would be a candidate that they would look at. It's difficult. I'm not too sure if. Do you think Ancelotti would appeal to him? I'm not sure. Or I don't know. Would he be expecting to keep his powder dry? Maybe for a more high ranking club or high profile club. I know Everton are a huge club in English football, but again, they're all going to have the same problem that they don't have.
Well, I mean, you know, it depends if you're going to go for a steady pair of hands. I mean, do we seriously think that Everton are relegation fodder? No, probably not. They're in a false position. So, you know, does that rule out Sam Allardyce to come in and firefight? Probably. But, you know, there are other names. I know Manuel Pellegrini is being heavily linked with the Leicester job, another vacant position. I wonder if Everton look to him. Maybe Roberto Mancini. You know, there's plenty on the market, you know.
Yeah, it's difficult to see. What, just given the makeup of that squad, it's difficult to see who can come in and improve it straight away. But I think maybe you mentioned Koeman's demeanour and maybe the reputation he has for being a little bit too self-assured. I think maybe it needs someone who can come in and really lift spirits, the likes of Ancelotti, if he would be interested in it. He's an obvious one.
Thanks to Everton's decision to fire Ronald Koeman, everything that you hear now was recorded earlier on. We look at other managers that are also under pressure. Let's just hope no one else gets fired, because we all want to go home. Well, let's talk about Slaven Bilic then. A thumping defeat at home to Brighton and Hove Albion on Friday night. It seems to be whenever the pressure was cranking up on Bilic at the start of the season, they turned it around. I think it was 8 points in the next five games or
they
something.
They turned it around against Huddersfield when the pressure was on.
And then again, it seems to be, they all seem to be going back to square one again. Is he as much in danger as Ronald Koeman at the moment? What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think after that result, I mean, let's not sugarcoat it. No team should be losing 3-0 at home to Brighton and Hove Albion. You know, that's no disrespect to them. A journeyman striker like Glenn Murray should not be walking away from your ground with two goals to his name.
He should if you've got Joe Hart.
Well, and again, you know, his performance, the decline in Hart is terrifying, I think, you know, for someone who, you know, 5 years ago was so instrumental, or 6 years ago so instrumental in Manchester City winning a Premier League title. But yeah, it's, you know, with a lot of these managers, like we touched on with Koeman, he didn't address his major problem, which was a goal scorer. Liverpool, they have not addressed their major problem, which is goalkeeper and two centre-backs. West Ham have got problems through the spine of that team. You know, they recruited fairly well, I'd say, you know, in Arnautovic and Hernandez in particular. But you look at that defence, you know, Jose Font is, you know, a rapidly declining force. Hart definitely is not of the calibre anymore. Pablo Zabaleta was a wonderful Premier League right-back, arguably the best, well, one of the best the division's ever known. But again, it's no disputing that teams target him as a weak link. And now Bilic has not addressed any of them problems. So a massive amount of the blame rests at his door.
I think as well, though, Steve, you're saying that you know, they recruited well, but those players haven't performed for him. They're so badly letting him down that I feel a little bit sorry for Bilic, because he brought in Joe Hart that, okay, his career hasn't been going too well of late, but you would still think that's someone with Premier League experience. Zabaleta, you know, he's coming to the end of his career, but that's someone with the right mentality anyway to have in the squad. Arnautovic, who, you know, gets himself sent off stupidly and then doesn't perform whenever he's on. He's their record signing, isn't he, at 24 odd million pounds. So Hernandez can't do it all himself. So I do feel as if everything's kind of conspiring against Bilic at the moment, but I also feel as well that it's horrible to say, but it just seems as if he's a dead man walking. You think that no matter if he turns this around like he did last season, he's not going to survive past the summer. So is it better now to cut your losses while the team are performing so badly, go for somebody else, rather than have this kind of rumble on? As you said, Johnny, there will be a rescue and some result that would rescue them, and then they'll slip back into their old problems again. And I just think that it'll be that way all season. So as much as it pains me to say it, maybe it's time to get rid.
He certainly doesn't help himself, though, because when he does play Hernandez and Andy Carroll at the same time, he doesn't play with them both up front together. He shunts Hernandez out on a wing. When have you ever seen Hernandez do anything effective outside of the penalty area? It just doesn't make any sense.
You're absolutely right. He scored, 40 Premier League goals? They've all come inside the area. That's where you need him.
Big man, little man.
Well, yeah. He doesn't create chances, does he? He doesn't skin defenders. That's where you need him. But yeah, I mean, you know, if Bilic was a dog and you were taking him to the vet, you would do the kind thing and have him put down, I think.
Wow.
But, you know, we touched on this last season. Bilic's second seasons at his clubs, he always starts off very well in his first seasons at clubs, has a massive dip in the second season. But that's now spilt over into the third season. And, you know, if we're going to talk about a catalyst for change, or you know, change being a catalyst for a change in fortunes, you've only got to look at Leicester City, who got rid of Craig Shakespeare, Michael Appleton in temporary charge. They go to Swansea, they win 3 points. The same with last season when they replaced Ranieri with Shakespeare. Fantastic run they went on. You know, it's change is good sometimes, and the sooner the better for struggling clubs.
You mentioned Leicester there. They've got Everton next weekend. So if they can continue their recent trend of caretaker managers going on a run of wins, then that could be, going back to Koeman, that could be the end of him, couldn't it?
Yeah, very much so. You know, I think we've been saying it every week for the past five now, that the next result is so important for Everton. And I think, you know, apart from, was it against Bournemouth they won when the Assey came on and scored twice? Yeah. The results have not been coming. It's a results business. But again, you don't look at that team and the performances and think, yeah, okay, they're creating, their performances haven't got the points that they've deserved. There's none of that. You know, it's a downward spiral, and something has to give.
Steve, you mentioned a key kind of area of why certain managers and clubs are struggling has been the inability to effectively recruit in the off-season the positions that they needed to, and that is none more obvious than at Liverpool. Let's go over to them, Johnny, and their performance against Tottenham, it's so abundantly clear what is going wrong with their team. And still, going back to what Jurgen Klopp had said a few weeks ago about that there wasn't a plan B when they couldn't sign Virgil van Dijk. I mean, there just doesn't... That's just inexcusable.
Yeah, beggar's belief, really. excuse me. It was so obvious yesterday on Sunday that they just couldn't cope with... I think Liverpool can be very, very good and can kind of paper over the cracks when they're playing teams that aren't of the standard of a Tottenham or a Manchester City. And you've seen that when they've come up against those two teams this year, that they've got absolutely hammered. And it goes back again to something we've spoken about before, is that they so obviously needed a decent centre, not even a decent centre-back, but a top-level centre-back in the summer. They put all their eggs in one basket with Van Dijk. It didn't happen. And it just surprises me. I can't get my head around it that you will have plumped for that one guy, and if you can't get him, that you've got no alternative and no backup to then go to. And Lovren to last 31 minutes, that it was obvious that he was struggling, and that's just kind of emphasises that, underlines it, that the fact that Klopp thought, I've got to get you off after half an hour into this game. And it's just... it's the same old problem. It's Liverpool's Achilles heel. It was last year. This year, they're even more blistering in attack, and you think they can blow away teams. But if they can't keep teams out at the other end, they've got absolutely no chance of top four. Up until the weekend, I thought that maybe they had enough firepower there that, as I said, would paper over those cracks. But it's difficult to see how they can rectify it before the January transfer window. And teams are just going to look at that performance, the Spurs performance, and just think we're going to exploit what is their obvious weakness.
That's it though, Steve. Can teams now work out Liverpool much easier than they might have done at first under Klopp? You know, he always talks about this heavy metal football and this gegenpressing style and all these fancy buzzwords, fashionable words. But yeah, Essentially, if you can sit back and not allow their front players to gain any space with their killer speed, and you can attack their centre-backs at will, then the result is there for the taking for any team in the Premier League.
Yeah, I mean, I've been racking my brain, and you two might be able to come up with an example. Can you think of a Premier League team that had such a disparity in terms of quality between their attack and their defence? Like, we all agree their attack is one of the best front four in the Premier League. But they are so poor at the back. And like you say, continuing on the theme of careers that hang in the balance, I think Dejan Lovren is in very real danger of never playing for Liverpool again. I mean, to be bought off, and it was the correct decision, to take him off after half hour in a massive game against Spurs at Wembley. Yeah, you may not see Lovren in a Liverpool shirt again, I think, after that performance. And now he was part of the problem. I agree that not recruiting a centre-back was criminal almost. But I thought Mignolet was so poor for at least three of the goals, maybe even all four. You know, I don't think he needs to rush off his line for the first one. I think if he stays on his line, that gives Harry Kane a much harder or much more difficulty to score that goal. I thought for the fourth goal coming for that cross, you know, I don't know why Mignolet can't get a hand or a glove on a cross, but he can't. He landed them in complete trouble. And even that goal, it was a comedy of errors. Liverpool didn't deal with the first ball, the second ball, or the third ball, as they didn't for Dele Alli's volley. Joel Matip's header was, again, very, very poor. And it was only really... even the second goal, I think, really, I think Son took it so quickly that there may have been an element of surprise that caught Mignolet out. But I don't think it would be too harsh to look at him and say he's at fault for three of them four goals, definitely. But again, and I think another interesting thing, I mean, I think you could look at Spurs. Now, whether you agree with this or not, I don't know. Last season, I thought they had the best defence in the Premier League, maybe even Europe. So it wasn't an obvious area where you thought Pochettino needed to strengthen. He went out and signed Davinson Sanchez, £42 million, Spurs record signing. And he's improved what was already an almost impregnable defence. But he's not made Spurs more defensive as a result of playing a three. He's made Spurs more attacking as a result. So it just goes to show that you can identify even areas of strength, let alone weaknesses, and make your team even better. And I think that's the major difference. Yeah, you know, I think probably Liverpool do have a deal lined up with Van Dijk. Probably, maybe not January, but definitely next summer. I think that deal, I'll be shocked if that doesn't happen. But to be prepared to go a full season without having another top-grade centre-back, yeah, that's why Liverpool are not going to win the league. They're not good enough defensively. Sure, they're good enough offensively, but they're going to concede just as many as they score.
I think Klopp's losing a little bit of his sheen, especially you see the way he comes across in press conferences recently. I still think he's a brilliant manager, but I know that Lovren was obviously at fault for some of the goals, one in particular, and Mignolet definitely. But I think that I think Klopp really does need to take some responsibility in that as well, because this was the season that we all expected them to get a little bit more consistent and Klopp to kind of figure it out a little bit more, the way Guardiola last year knew and identified an obvious weakness in the Manchester City team at fullbacks, etc., and rectified that and found a solution to it and understood it. But for Klopp just to, I don't know, obviously they've tried to get in players and tried to remedy it, but I just think that Klopp and the coaching staff that he has, because especially the type of manager he is, there's a lot of importance placed on the guys he has around him for tactics and getting shape and really helping players develop. I think that we're just seeing a little bit of the kind of halo slipping with him, and I think he criticise the desire last night of the players?
Yeah, totally.
Well, you know,
it's weird, not the only manager to do that this weekend.
Yeah, yeah. But for someone who's so, like, the whole kind of aura of Klopp is all about his positivity and his energy, and as you said, Johnny, like heavy metal football and cavalier kind of persona and everything like that. I think that he needs to find a way, and he needs to find a way before January, obviously, or the summer if it's Van Dijk, to get Liverpool anywhere near the standard they need to be in the top four.
I just want to expand on what you quickly touched on with Tottenham, Steve. I mean, the knives have been out from us for most of the show so far. We've been criticising a lot of people. Let's before we criticise some more managers,
he wants to send Pillage to the bed.
Let's touch on what a fantastic job Pochettino did. Not only this weekend at Real Madrid, what he's building at Tottenham so far as well. I mean, the Wembley hoodoo seems to be very much shaken off now. Stellar job he's doing over there. That's one manager that certainly isn't under any pressure.
No, absolutely not. And I think the thing that has come to the fore very much over the past few performances is his selection. Now, I don't think anyone, including most Spurs fans, expected him to go with two up front against Real Madrid at the Bernabeu. And, you know, Fernando Llorente didn't uproot any trees, but it certainly gave Real Madrid something else to think about, and the same against Liverpool as well. I don't think last season we would have lined up without Dyer as a holding midfielder, and I don't think they played Song quite as close as they did to Harry Kane. But you know, you look at the players that Spurs were missing in that game as well: Ben Davies, Danny Rose, Victor Wanyama, Moussa Dembele. Like I said, Eric Dyer dropped, so they could accommodate an extra attacking player. And I think it's put him in a real position of strength now that teams, even his own fans, are going to be second-guessing what lineup he's going to go with in big games now.
Yeah, I totally agree with all of that, and think that where we're saying that maybe Klopp hasn't perhaps learned from the problems last year, I think Pochettino has, where you've seen it against Dortmund, you've seen it against Real Madrid, and now against Liverpool, that I think Tottenham seem a little bit more game-smart, whereas they don't need to rely on that high press and 100% of the time, where they can sit back and soak it up. I thought yesterday was very impressive, the fact that once they had gone 4-1 up, and I know it's a very big cushion to have and comfortable cushion to have, but just the fact that they saw out the game very well. And okay, Lloris made an incredible save from Coutinho.
What a save.
Yeah, absolutely.
What a save.
Brilliant. And did the same, made a good save from Milner and Salah, I think, although they were a lot easier. But I think that you never felt as if they were going to cave And I think that's been a big change in terms of the mentality in the team.
What about Antonio Conte at Chelsea? I mean, he seems to have been under pressure. They did get the win at the weekend against Watford, but once again, it was far from convincing from the champions. That rock-solid defence that almost led them to the title last year is being penetrated every single game at the moment, and with ease. I mean, do you see too much? He's obviously got plenty of credit in the bank with the fans, but that doesn't seem to matter too much to the Chelsea hierarchy. What do you? He should be all right for most of the season. Would you think? What do you kind of? How do you kind of see it unfolding with Conte over at Chelsea?
It's a bit of a mixed one, isn't it? Because I think, but for some wayward finishing from who up until now, Richarlison has been a very reliable and very prolific finisher for Watford. Yeah, it could have finished 4-2 the other way. But, you know, when you've got a prolific marksman and creator like Cesar Azpilicueta popping up with goals, he's such a wonderful player. We mention Kevin De Bruyne every week. I don't think we mention Azpilicueta nearly enough. But, yeah, it's getting to the point now where you always feel like he's one game away from crisis talk, don't you? I mean, obviously they had a terrible result against Palace, surrendered a two-goal lead against Roma in the Champions League. But, you know, they do what good teams do. They find a way to win. And, you know, scoring four goals when you're playing that badly can't be a terrible thing. But, yeah, you're right, though. Despite a 4-2 win should be celebrated, but there's something that just sits a little bit uneasy about Conte and Chelsea this season.
I think it's, again, dating back to the start of the season where he didn't get the players that he wanted, and he was pretty vocal in that. And you can tell that he's not entirely happy with the squad, especially because they've got Champions League football this year, and you know they're doing very well in that. I think it's this power struggle that there seems to be between Conte and the Chelsea hierarchy, and as you touched upon there, Johnny, you know there's only one winner in that. We've seen that traditionally the manager is the most disposable figure at Stamford Bridge most of the time. So I still think Conte's job's safe, and I think he would only leave before the end of the season, and I do very much feel that he will leave at the end of the season if things continue as they do. But I think that he will only leave it before the end of the season off his own back. I don't think he would be pushed out unless there's a huge downturn in results like there was with Mourinho last year. But I just think that there's a number of things that are affecting Chelsea. The fact that, remember last year, Conte had a full week to prepare his team, and he's a manager who everyone says prides him on his ability to mould a team and set up a team to get the result that he wants for each specific match and his passion, etc. And I do believe that I don't see any sign that the players aren't playing for him. You know, he brought on Batshuayi, comes on and hasn't had the best of times and didn't seem to be enjoying his time there from what people were saying, but he came on and scored a couple of goals and helped turn around the result. So I think that suggests that everyone's still with him, and I would imagine that it's just going to take a little bit of perseverance until January, and then they'll maybe get in a few players, because as we know they missed out on the likes of Llorente, Barkley,
Lukaku.
Oxlade-Chamberlain, Alexandro at left back. They don't really have proper cover there, I would suggest. So, you know, there's things that went wrong in the summer for him, and as I said, he's been very vocal about that, but I don't think they've got any reason to panic.
Should Mark Hughes be in trouble at Stoke City? I mean, every other club that's down there that arguably shouldn't be have made changes, or like Bournemouth are starting to kind of climb out of it, whereas Stoke have kind of fallen back into it. But is the tough start to the season kind of giving him a bit of extra, a bit of leeway? What do you think? Do you think Mark Hughes should be feeling the pressure?
Yeah, I think they've faced Arsenal, Manchester United, Chelsea and City all in their first 9 games. And I think, realistically speaking, I think they beat Arsenal and drew with United, which is probably a better return than they would have thought. But they've got a nice run of games coming up. Watford, Leicester, Brighton and Palace before they play Liverpool. So I think the board would probably have thought that maybe they would have been at least 3 points better off than they are. But, yeah, I think it was a difficult start to the season. I think the next run of games, the four teams I just mentioned, it's crucial that he takes a significant amount of points from there. I'm talking maybe 3 wins from four of those games. But yeah, you know, it was They only moved out of the bottom three by virtue of Everton being so poor and conceding five goals at the weekend. So, yeah, they're if we're lumping all these other struggling managers into this category, then he's got to be mentioned in the same breath, I think.
I think his defence isn't helping him out, or the whole team at the moment. The fact that I think they've conceded the most goals in the Premier League, and I know that's skewed slightly by getting thumped at Manchester City, but I would think that, as Steve says, we're nine games into the season, and it's they've had a very, very difficult start. But the pressure will be on. It'll turn very quickly on him if they don't get the results in the next few matches.
You think last season, was it, they didn't win their first match until the end of October or beginning of November? So, you know, he's got form for turning it around. I mean, they got that out of the way with the win against Arsenal. But they're in a real anomaly, aren't they? Because I thought they were fantastic against Arsenal. Thought really, really good against Manchester United. But yeah, just in games where you would expect them to be a little bit more, combative, and in the games that they've not been. City that day would have put seven goals past, Barcelona and Brazil. They were unstoppable that day. So I think you almost kind of chalk that one off completely. But yeah, I think that the next run of games up to Liverpool, they're four teams that Stoke would identify as teams they would be looking to take maximum points or to at least be unbeaten after that four-game sequence. And if he doesn't do that, then that's another conversation.
I think it depends where the club owners, where they want to go in terms of, has Hugh been there 5 years?
Up the table, I would think.
Has he been there 5 years? So it's, are they happy and content with just being a mid-table Premier League team, or someone who strives to get into the top 10 or fights for that bracket of, what is it, below the top six, really, and the relegation? But I think that the fact that Leicester won the league a few years ago and there's a lot more because of the vast amount of money that's come into the Premier League, I think maybe teams have ideas above their station, really, and expectations that aren't grounded in reality. So they think then, okay, if they can do this, or if we can attract these players and pay them this sort of money and spend this amount of cash, that we should be expecting better results for that. So I think that does put the pressure on everybody, and people, especially the likes of Mark Hughes, who's expected to maybe win that second league or contest that these days because of the amount of financial backing he's been given.
But then everyone's got the same financial backing, mm-hmm. haven't they? Mm-hmm. So as you said, that everyone has higher expectations, but then that just elevates with everyone else's. Other big talking points from this past weekend?
Sufiane Boufal's goal.
Goal
of the season.
Unbelievable.
Against West Brom.
Settled one of the worst, what could have been one of the worst games of the season with an absolute piece of magic. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was worth the wait there.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, what was it? Five or six defenders. I'm sure the players can laugh now, but just the sight of seeing two West Brom defenders clatter into each other just because of his trickery. The no-look step over as well, and the finish as well. A lot of players will be tempted to give that shot a little bit of elevation, giving the goalkeeper a nice height to get a hand on it. He doesn't. He plants that on the floor. And as you pointed out, it's the 85th minute, so he's probably knackered at the end of that run anyway. So to have enough wits about him to put that in the one place a goalkeeper is going to find it really tough to get a hand on, I just thought it was superb. Are there any other goals that stick out for us?
From this weekend?
No. We're a quarter of the way through the season, aren't we? I can only really think of Charlie Daniels' Bournemouth against Man City.
Yeah, that was magic, wasn't
it? But beyond that, I think two...
Pedro's opener against Watford this weekend.
Oh, it was brilliant as well, wasn't it?
And from the edge of the area.
First time.
Yeah, that was a great goal as well. But
I think some of the City's goals, because of Kevin
De
Bruyne.
So many, I can't remember.
They're more, they're more team goals than a bit of individual brilliance. But I struggled to get anything that would rival Boufal. It was fantastic.
And that's him done for the next 3 months, and then another piece of magic.
Yeah, exactly.
Sergio Aguero, of course, big weekend for him.
Massive. I mean, it's a case of when and not if, isn't it, that he actually breaks the record. But he restored to the lineup, much to the chagrin of most of us who had Gabriel Jesus in our fantasy Premier League team, I'm sure. But it's 177 goals in, when was it he joined, 2011? It's just phenomenal. And you're looking at his stats at his age. Alan Shearer's Premier League record might even be on his radar. He's that good playing in a team that are going to score tons and tons of goals. I can see him actually lining up against Wolves on Tuesday night in the League Cup, probably just to get the goal, to get it out of the way. Obviously, might not be the most glamorous occasion, but doing it at the Etihad, I think it would make sense if Guardiola lined him up in that game.
As you said, Steve, it's not too far away, is it? It's going to be within his next few appearances. It's a phenomenal record. And again, it's someone who maybe there were question marks at the start of the season just to see if Guardiola completely trusted him. But he's just answered any question marks that anybody had. And I could see him. I think Harry Kane's top goal scorer at the moment with 8 goals. But if Aguero stays fit, which is obviously always the big thing with him, I think he'll push him very, very hard for it. I would fancy him over Harry Kane, to be honest.
We're now joined on the phone by Richard Jolly in Bolton. Huddersfield Town pulled off a magnificent win over Manchester United on Saturday. But it was the manner of the defeat that left Jose Mourinho incandescent at his players after the match, questioning his players' application and attitude in the 2-1 defeat. Richard, you were at the game and would really like to get your thoughts on it. Just how bad were Manchester United? How good were Huddersfield Town?
Well, first of all, I thought Huddersfield were outstanding. They played above themselves. They were a team that was greater than the sum of their parts. Some of those players, I think you wouldn't really believe they could have played that well. And as Jose Mourinho and Ander Herrera both admitted, Huddersfield were very, very deserving winners. Having said all of that, United were poor. It was the most critical Mourinho has ever been of his team in his time there. And we thought the attitude was all wrong. And it was, they didn't really get going. Even at the end when Rashford scored and there was a bit more urgency and they were putting Huddersfield under a bit of pressure, they weren't actually playing particularly well. And it was a performance that to a certain extent had been coming. United hadn't played brilliantly away at Liverpool. They hadn't played brilliantly away at Benfica. But equally, they'd done the basics very well in all the other games. They'd been defensively very, very good. They'd only conceded 2 league goals all season. Then they go to Huddersfield and concede 2 more within 6 minutes of each other, and in fairly shambolic fashion. And so I don't think anyone could completely have seen that one coming. Mourinho certainly didn't. And it puts more pressure on United to bounce back now in much bigger games against Chelsea and Tottenham.
Well, that's it. I want to ask you, Richard, how do you see United responding from this? I mean, of course, a defeat at any time of the season is not great, particularly at the moment with the way that Manchester City are flying. And they can't, get too far ahead of everyone else. Otherwise, it could be game over by the new year. But if a defeat like this is going to happen and Mourinho is going to be critical of his players' attitude, with Tottenham Hotspur coming up next weekend, perhaps it's the fire that, the fire under the belly that they kind of need to kind of refocus, regroup and kind of go again with such a big game coming up next weekend?
Yeah, certainly. And if you look at Mourinho's record over the years, one of the reasons why he's been so successful is that with the exception of those last few months at Chelsea, he normally gets a response very, very quickly to a defeat or to a bad performance. It's not often at all that a Jose Mourinho team will lose 2 in a row, let alone 3. United actually lost 3 in a row last September, but apart from that, he's not lost consecutive games, even when he was rotating his squad last season because of the Europa League and things like that. So I would expect a response. I think it would be interesting to see which team Mourinho names against Tottenham. I mean, he took both Anthony Martial and Juan Mata off at half-time at Huddersfield, which was a real sign he wasn't happy with either of their performances. Obviously, his options are limited to some degree because Fellaini and Pogba are out, and I think in an ideal world for Mourinho, he'd have at least one and possibly both of them starting against Spurs. But I think attitude's a big thing. Mourinho brought up the issue of their attitude. I would expect a much better attitude against Tottenham. And in a big home game at Old Trafford, one where they're not such hot favourites, that might actually suit them as an occasion.
Richard, you mentioned team selection there. One of the key things that Mourinho will hope, or one of the key players he'll hope to be fit in time for Tottenham, of course, is Phil Jones, who came off during the first half of the defeat to Huddersfield. His replacement, Victor Lindelof, looked shaky at best. It's taking him a fair bit of time to adjust to the Premier League, to his new team. Now, if Mourinho is looking to produce a solid defensive display against an impressive attack like Tottenham's, then he's going to really hope that his kind of key preferred defenders are available to him. Now, how do you see that going? Will we see Lindelof in the firing line again if Phil Jones isn't fit for Tottenham?
Well, it's if Phil Jones and if Eric Bailly aren't fit, because Lindelof is fourth in line, and he's very much fourth in line. So if either of the other two is fit, that player will partner Chris Smalling. Mourinho has made it clear he doesn't really consider Daley Blind a centre-back, even though he actually did pretty well there a couple of seasons ago for Louis van Gaal. But yeah, to go back to Lindelof, he was poor in pre-season. He had a difficult game in the Super Cup against Real Madrid when both Bailly and Jones were suspended. He'd actually played pretty well in the Champions League games, but he'd only had 1 minute of Premier League football. Then Jones comes off, and maybe in Lindelof's defence, it's harder for him to come into a game after 20 minutes than starting one. But he didn't look up. He didn't look able to cope with the intensity of it or with the physicality of Huddersfield. He struggled against Laurent Depoitre, a real bull of a centre-forward who had a very, very good game. I mean, I understood what Mourinho said after the game, where he said he didn't want to blame Lindelof for the mistake that led to the second goal. And he was right in the sense of it's probably not fair just to make one player a scapegoat when the entire team has played that badly. But it was a very, very strange decision to duck that punt forward from Jonas Lersel. And it backfired as it let Bailly through on goal. But, I mean, I don't think the Jones injury looked that severe. We're still not sure about Bailly. So it very much depends on their fitness. But what it did show was how important those two are. Because even with United playing badly, if Phil Jones had stayed on the pitch, maybe they'd have just ground out a 0-0 draw and been able to call it a valuable point.
So, Richard, after the kind of criticism that Mourinho received for not giving it a go at Anfield and coming away with a 0-0 draw there, the defeat against Huddersfield Town, now welcoming Tottenham to Old Trafford next weekend, how do you see him lining this team up? Do you see again a park the bus type of performance? Do you see his team being a bit more adventurous and trying to go for it? I mean, Mourinho's never really been one to care of outside influences. How do you, in your kind of opinion, how do you see him lining up next weekend?
Well, he won't go gung-ho, as you say. I mean, he doesn't do that, but equally, his most defensive performances have all come away from home. Anfield this season and Anfield last season are very much cases in point. And he won't be as negative at home. I think that's a very safe bet. And the other reason he won't be is one you've already referred to, is that they can't afford to drop too much further behind Manchester City. Now, the approach at Anfield might have been predicated on a theory of, OK, we'll take a 0-0 draw at Liverpool, then we'll go and beat Huddersfield. Having lost to Huddersfield, they're 5 points behind City. If they then play for a 0-0 draw against Tottenham, say they get it, say then City go and beat West Brom a couple of hours later, the gap's up to 7 points. So I think we will see a more adventurous United. And also that with the way that Pochettino's teams play, sometimes you can get a more open game against them. But United, I mean, don't forget, United, even when they weren't playing particularly well last season, still beat Tottenham at home and still played with some sense of adventure. So I wouldn't expect a 5-4 by any means, but I don't think that this one is a guaranteed 0-0, put it that way.
Excellent stuff, Richard. Well, thanks very much for your time this week. Much appreciated, as always.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Take care. Check back with Extra Time later this week as we preview the next weekend of fixtures, highlighted by a top three showdown between Manchester United and Tottenham. Thanks to Steve Luckings, John McCauley and Richard Jolly for joining us, as well as Kevin Jeffers, our producer. Subscribe to Extra Time on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. We're also online at thenational.ae/sport. I'm John Turner for The National. Thanks for listening.